Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this programme we mix it all up with a new exhibition of collage, we hear from Willie Mason on his current UK tour, and we consider the return of the Goblin King himself with a new offering from David Bowie. With me as ever to battle through the dark forces and rescue the talisman from the castle are Dave Allen and Simon Mobbs. Dave, Simon, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good, thank you.
Good, good. Nice to see you again. And we're going to start tonight, we're going to kick it all off with an exhibition at the Pallant House Gallery in Chichester, and it's Kitai. Simon, you can give us a bit of context to this one.
Certainly. The title of the exhibition is Obsessions, and Kitai certainly has a lot of obsessions within his work, which come through in the exhibition, which is very much a retrospective. Over his career, he's been particularly interested in, for example, reading and referencing literary texts. He's very much into history, politics and modern literature. He's also very much interested in the female form, and sex plays quite a big part in a lot of his paintings. He's interested in people. He lived in a very famous circle of friends, and he also based a lot of his work on fictional characters that existed within culture or that he made up himself. Also, towards the end of his career, after a lot of harsh criticism, he became very bitter and waged a war against critics. And in some ways, the last period of his work is very much about revenge and a kind of anti-critic approach.
And what's his style? You know, we say, I mentioned collage, and I think we're going to talk about collage later. Some people will think of that as sticking bits of paper together, but this is a lot more complex than that.
I think there is an element of collage in his work, but it's not the first word I would use. He describes himself as a neo-cubist, and he mixes together mostly in painting, although he has used screen printing and collage, but primarily he's a painter. And what he does is he mixes quite often different styles within the same painting, which is in some ways a collage type effect. So, for example, some of his figures will be very realistic, almost photorealistic in the way they've been painted. Some will be very minimal and almost cartoon-like, influenced by, say, strip cartoons. Some elements will be very abstract, and there's a kind of perspectivelessness to his work, if you know.
Perspectivelessness?
Yes, I read that in the catalogue, okay. And I thought that was good, and I'm glad I managed to present that. But I do know what they mean. It's not quite going by normal conventions of how to compose and create a 3D space. You're not quite sure if elements are 2D or 3D or quite where you are. It's a little bit dreamlike in parts. And yes, you could say it's a montage, collage-y type approach, but through primarily painting.
I think I got lost at neo-cubism, but you'll probably be able to help me out there. Can you just perhaps describe one of the pieces? You've got one in front of you there. And again, art on radio is always difficult, but it's very vivid, isn't it? It's very kind of immediate.
Yes. I mean, this is the piece that has been reproduced on the posters and the exhibition catalogue, and it's the one you'll see the most around. This piece is called Juan de la Cruz from 1967, which is a large oil painting. What you've got is, for example, the main figure is a young American black soldier who's fighting in the Vietnam War, and then he's pointing into his pocket. In the background, you've then got things which are done in quite a different style. So, for example, his face is depicted in quite a realistic style. He uses very light brush technique of paint, and it almost looks like a photocopy. You can see the texture of the canvas coming through in parts. But then in contrast to this quite realistically drawn face, in the background you've got very cartoony images, which happen to show images of women that are naked and are being, I would say, degraded. So, for example, you've got one woman who's kind of walking to a watery grave with her hands tied by what looks like these gangsters, which are very much stereotypical gangsters that you might see in a Dick Tracy comic. And then you've got another woman that seems to be being treated by what looks like to be a cartoon ghost. And then beyond that, you've got a background which maybe is the inside of a plane.
Sounds like a bad dream I had once.
Yeah, you see what I mean? And this has got multitude of colours, and you're not quite sure if it's a 3D space or if it's kind of 2D abstract forms. But like you say, it's very vivid, it's very colourful, it's very striking. Some of the imagery is shocking. And yeah, I can see why he'd be compared to the pop artists when I see images like this.
And what was the reference to the pocket?
Well, it's been called a mystery picture, and the thing that I get from it, before I read into the meanings of it, is that it feels very much like it could be a cover, a fine art style cover to, say, a pulp novel or a kind of B-movie, in that he's kind of defiantly looking at the camera, and he's pointing to his pocket as if, I'm innocent, I'm not guilty, I'm proving something here. And then you've got these images of crimes against women being committed in the background. Maybe I'm reading into it, but that's how I read it. But when reading what the title of the actual image is called, Juan de la Cruz, from what I can understand, Juan de la Cruz is the national personification of the Philippines, the Filipino everyman. So, for example, if we say in America you have John Doe's, in the Philippines you would say Juan de la Cruz, the everyday Filipino man, for example. And they're often portrayed as a victim of American imperialism, which is interesting as he's a Vietnamese black soldier.
It's kind of our John Bull, is that what kind of
yes,
what you're
getting yeah.
Dave, let's bring you in here, because Kitai is someone I think that's crossed your radar previously. And there's an element of this which is, I think, about the kind of Jewish-American tradition, but with a sort of heavy English feel.
Yeah, it's partly that he's of that generation of artists that had made a big impression on me when I first became an art student towards the late 60s, because he was associated with the British pop movement, you know, with Hockney and Blake and all those people. But he is significantly different, you know, because whereas, you know, David Hockney's a Yorkshire lad who fetched up at the Royal College, and Peter Blake's an ordinary English lad who fetched up at the Royal College and had relatively conventional English upbringings, you know, as you say, Kitai's life was quite complex, you know, and in fact he took his stepfather's surname, Kitai's his stepfather's surname, so there's a you know, kind of long history there, and European Jewish and American, and at one point served in the American army, and then comes as an older student than people like Blake and Hockney. He turns up at the Royal College at that time when everything was really vibrant, you know, and Ken Russell had come in the early 60s and made this film about these really promising young pop artists who do become big. And Kitai is both a part of it and somehow apart from it as well. I think that what's really interesting about all of those people is that they come in the late 50s and early 60s on the back end of the dominance of American abstraction. And by American abstraction, I'm talking about these huge canvases, which are literally non-figurative. There are no hints at figures in them. No, you can look at Rothko's painting and think there's a landscape or a seascape, but it's not that. It's just paint on canvas. You can look at Pollock's splashes and try and psychoanalyze it, but it's not. It's painting on canvas. And suddenly, you know, you get Peter Blake painting pictures of himself with all his badges on his jean jacket, and you get Hockney painting pictures of real people, and Kitai too. So although the images that these guys produce are not classically realist in the 19th century and prior sense, they do break up perspective, they do pick up the lessons of Picasso and so on. Nonetheless, they do return images of what we would call real things, you know, the thing that Simon's talking about. Is it a room? There is a woman. There is a man, a black man. We can see he's a black man and so on and so on. So it leads us to speculate on what it might be. I mean, the other thing that's said about Kitai is that he has this desperate experience in the late 90s when he gets this apparently prestigious show at the Tate Gallery and is hammered by these really, really unpleasantly hammered by these critics. And the consensus is, A, that it was unfair, and B, that what they didn't like about him, and this is always said to be a typically English attitude, they didn't like his cleverness. They didn't like that he was a learned man. You know, Peter Blake said, I want to paint paintings that are like pop music. But Kitai read philosophy and literature, and although it looks poppy, it doesn't refer to pop images. It's not like Lichtenstein, who's at the moment at the Tate, you know, with comic books. It's not comic book art at all. It's really quite complex stuff and very interesting for all of that.
It's a little bit like, I think, Albert Camus, you know, being a great footballer, but also a novelist and a philosopher and all those kind of things. Oh, no, you can't do both. You can't mix the two. Yes. It's just not on.
And he's a significant, wrote quite a lot, from what I understand, short stories, and he wrote kind of agendas, what would you call them, he wrote kind of manifestos for artists to follow, and I think he wrote a poem in 617 verses at one point. It's, you know, he was very much somebody who gained inspiration from books, and from what I understand, about 10 years of his career, he didn't actually paint from life at all. He just would read and paint from these ideas that came from the books that he read.
There's a thread, I think, of through his work. One of the things that strikes me, and I don't know a great deal about him, I have to confess, but there's a thread in his work about tragedy and about loss. Mm. And certainly from reading just up on his biography, if you like, you know, it's clear to me at a very young age he lost some significant people in his life. But also he himself, I think, committed suicide in sort of 2007.
Eventually, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Eventually, yeah, which, yeah. You know, I mean, I know it's sort of, it sounds kind of cliche to say, but, you know, a number of artists kind of, you know, are tormented, aren't they, and kind of hounded by particular things.
Yeah.
I was interested, Dave, in what you said about, you know, being an influence on pop art, but not necessarily an actor, but kind of being that sort of an editor at large in some ways.
Well, it's clear that he was part of a London world where people shared ideas, and in fact there is a quote in the exhibition where he says something about the fact that without those conversations you can't make that kind of art, which is interesting because I think there are some artists who do perpetuate that idea of the lone artist in the gallery, in the garret, who's not ever going to talk to anybody and just gets on with it. But he clearly was a man who exchanged ideas, and in fact he exchanged them with people beyond that pop art milieu as well. So he knew I think Auerbach and Bacon and the more expressive painters of the time. But again, painters that were doing something different from from the grand American thing, which just for a brief while seemed like it was going to dominate the world. We have to recognise too that what was happening in the 60s, for mysterious reasons, I think, in some respects, the British painters were suddenly coming to prominence at the same time as British filmmakers, British designers, British fashion designers, and of course, most notably, the British pop musicians. You know, and there was this extraordinary cultural surge, and you know, it did embrace people from other countries who came to Britain. But I think when things got tougher, what happened was that some of the critics began to differentiate somewhat and say, well, we're not so sure about all this European stuff, really. We'll get a bit niggly with him. One of the things I would say about this show and about the reviews of this show that I've read, and incidentally, there is a parallel show, isn't there, in London, because some parts of this are very much about the Jewish issue that he explores in later life. So there is an exhibition at the Jewish Museum in London that parallels this. I think this rehabilitates him. The tragedy of it is that, as you alluded to it, that his first wife had committed suicide. His second wife, who he was very close to, I think died of a heart attack. I can't quite remember, but she certainly got very
aneurysm.
Yeah, she got very ill shortly after this dreadful Tate Gallery thing, where he was clearly out of his mind with depression at the way he'd been treated. And he always blamed the critics for her illness. Mm. And he never, ever really recovered. And eventually he killed himself as well. In the exhibition, there is a glass case full of letters from fellow artists, really major artists, protesting about this and writing about it and so on. So it's kind of funny that funny's not the right word, of course, but it's interesting that in a sense that whole controversy is now coming back to bite the critics, who are quite prominent critics, you know, who started it off in the first place. And Chris Kitaj is the one who's being rehabilitated by these shows, I think.
I think that's something I'd like to mention there, because that's definitely a significant part of the exhibition. It's really how, if you go around it in order, that's the end of the exhibition you end on, is this room where it's got the letters that were written with regards to the Tate retrospective show and what he called the Tate Wars afterwards. Yes. And it's also got paintings such as The Killer Critic, which very graphically depict him, and another artist, Manet, who I understand also had a lot of harsh criticism, both shooting this monstrous multi-headed beast of a kind of critic that's got blood on its hands. Very much he believed that they aimed at him, but they got his wife instead. And in his mind, whether this is the case or not, but certainly in his mind, he feels that it was the critics that finished his wife off. And he left the country soon after that, after exhibiting work such as this Killer Critic at a London show.
So is the exhibition at Pallant House, do you think it's exploring partly the kind of creativity of depression, being obsessive and obsessing about, you know, particular things?
Yeah, I think it did become an obsession for him by the looks of it. Certainly that comes through in the paintings. I don't want to kind of dwell on it too much, but I think it's just worth giving a brief flavour of the kind of criticisms he got in 1994. Bear in mind, this is his retrospective. He'd have been in his 60s at the time. This was meant to be a celebratory event. Mm. He had an opening night where a lot of the glitterati of the London, you know, art scene were there, and he's a very sociable person, and it was a very positive event. the next morning, all these reviews come out, and they're just awfully negative about the show, and some would argue personal as well. In particular, there's one by Andrew Graham Dixon, and this surprised me because he's this rather nice sort of foppish looking chap. But in 94, I mean, he said that Kitaj was the man who would leapfrog his way into history on the backs of giants stands exposed. Mm. He goes on to call his paintings cold-hearted. He says that his work is trite, and that he's referencing these great artists but not really understanding what he's referencing as he's doing it. And he goes on to compare him to the wizard from The Wizard of Oz, and that he's a small man with a large megaphone. It's pretty personal stuff, I would say. This, you can then see why him and his friends, for example, I think it was one of his architect friends, who rallied around and got this round-robin letter, which was signed by Patrick Caulfield, David Hockney, various people like this, to complain to the newspapers who published these articles that they were too personal and they went too far.
One of the comments I was going to make, Graham Dixon is exactly that, you know, on telly now. He's a very likeable and very erudite man. I think part of the thing is he's 20 years on, and there is a real problem with young critics, which I've experienced in a different kind of academic context, which is that they are sometimes so desperate to make a name for themselves that they will play a game in which they are more important than the artists. Mm. And I think it was a pretty shameful thing that he did, frankly. I mean, I'm a lot less surprised that Brian Sewell hammered into it, because Brian Sewell, you know, by his nature, really. I mean, actually, if you were a relatively contemporary artist, you'd be somewhat alarmed if Sewell liked your work, really, you know. So that's a different kind of issue. But the other problem about it is, in the end, it can become such a kind of significant part of the exhibition that you're in danger of missing the art. You know, one of the things about him is what a wonderful draftsman he is. There are some quite beautiful drawings, you know, some quite conventional figurative drawings in there in places. There was one in particular of just a horizontal woman, you know, on her stomach just lying down, and it could have been done in a life drawing class, and it was just delightful. The sort of thing that takes my breath away, because you know, I just have all those memories of, as an art student, of struggling my way through life drawing and desperately trying to get it right and so on. And I have to say that I like the intelligence and the kind of intellectual element of the whole thing as well. But he is a really fine draftsman, and those reviews in the 90s were dreadful things, really.
I felt I was maybe not quite as won over by the exhibition. I did enjoy it, but not wholeheartedly. I agree, I think he's definitely a really good draftsman, and from what I understand, he actually didn't draw for a good 10 years of his career, and then when he returned to it, he really went into it with a passion. And there is, as Dave said, there's a whole room dedicated to figurative studies done in actual pastel. You know, he's clearly a fine drawer, and I think he put together a manifesto called The Human Clay and an exhibition which encouraged artists in the UK to actually use the figure as the starting point, and he really went back into it with a lot of momentum. But what I do find, and this is a criticism I've read of his work, is that sometimes there's symbolism which is supposed to be in his work which is quite difficult to find. In particular, there's one about fascism. I can't remember the exact title, but it's got fascism in the title, and you've essentially got three naked or semi-clothed women on a beach, and it's got quite gritty textures. And you've also got an aircraft kind of arriving. And it's meant to be, I read the explanations behind this, and there's meant to be all sorts of things that it symbolises about fascism and about what was going on in Europe at the time. And with the exception of, for example, the fighter plane that's approaching, I find it very difficult to see that symbolism within the paintings. They certainly have a mood, and they certainly, you know, kind of get me on another level, but I sometimes found that the long explanations didn't necessarily come through in the image.
So is this an exhibition that we should send folks along to?
Yes.
I would say yes, but maybe not quite to the extent that I've kind of praised other exhibitions there before. So I think that I felt a bit baffled and confused at some points, but in a very charming way.
You can see R.B. Kitaj, Obsessions Analyst for Our Time, at the Pallant House Gallery in Chichester, and the exhibition is on till the 16th of June. We move now to music and Willie Mason, and I was lucky enough to catch up with Willie for his recent set at Pie and Vinyl promoting his new album, Carry On. I'm very pleased to be with Willie Mason. Willie, how are you doing?
I'm great, thank you.
Excellent, excellent set.
Thanks.
And you're in great voice, which is I'm pleased to hear.
Thanks.
So tell us about your new album, Carry On, which came out in December, I think, of last year.
Yeah, it's got 11 or 12 tracks of
songs that I wrote and recorded in South London in Streatham. Very happy about it.
And how would you describe your sound on this album? Are there changes from previous records? Or?
It's like a singer-songwriter getting tangled in an old tractor. Or an old washing machine, maybe more. You know, an old belt-driven washing machine.
Okay, tell me about the production of the record, because you had Dan Carey, I think, produce your latest record.
Yeah.
How important was the sort of production in terms of this album?
Dan played a pretty big part in it. I'd kind of call it a musical collaboration. This batch of songs left a lot more to interpretation than previous recordings I've done, so I brought in Dan as sort of a collaborator.
And he's worked with Hot Chip and Connelly and others.
And The Kills and
I guess a lot of people were worried your sound might move towards theirs. Was that a worry for you? You worried you're going to sound like Kylie?
I wish I could sound like Kylie.
I'm sure lots of folks do. Would you say it's fair to say your music is kind of in the blues Americana bracket? Is that how you would describe it? Or
sure, there's a lot of that. Yeah, I've been calling it wonky tonk lately.
Wonky tonk. That's a great description. Mm. Now, inevitably, for someone again in your trade, there have been comparisons to Bob Dylan and Johnny Cash, but those are good things, I guess.
I mean, to me, it just means that we need more songwriters. If everybody who can string a line together gets compared to Bob Dylan, then we're kind of in dire straits. There's a lot of great songwriters from America and the rest of the world. But
tell me about some of the sounds, some of the songs that you grew up with, because your parents are both folk singers, I think, or quite sort of big in the folk movement. What sort of things was a young Willie Mason listening to?
Mostly just to them, just to my parents singing. Before I started buying my own records, it was just live music around the house, really. Actually, that's not totally true. My dad was playing Frank Zappa and the Everly Brothers.
Quite a mix.
Just those two.
And you, I think when you were quite young, you moved from New York to Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah.
Was that quite a shift?
Yeah, when I got to the Vineyard, there was only 8 kids in my class.
So you had lots of space to grow, kind of mentally and in terms of your songwriting.
Plenty of room. Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Maybe that's where the tractor thing comes from.
From room. Yeah. Tractor, room, people, yeah, something like that.
And you've done, through your career today, you've done lots of work with other artists. You've worked with the Chemical Brothers, you worked with Isabel Campbell and Mark Langan. Have you got sort of other plans to do other bits of collaboration, or I suppose you've got a lot of freedom as a solo artist.
Yeah.
Other things on the horizon, or?
Sure, yeah, I'm sort of having a lot of fun with collaboration these days. When I was younger, I wasn't very good at communicating, so that made that difficult, but
does it bring out different things?
Yeah, it brings out different ideas, and you get to learn a lot working with other people.
You've done, I think, quite a few gigs in fairly small venues, and you're obviously playing Pine Vinyl today. What kind of, as an artist, what kind of approach do you take to the scale of a gig, if you like? Because obviously playing a festival is very different from playing
it's very
Pine
different.
Vinyl shop.
I mean, this is more like what I'm used to. I grew up playing music in this kind of environment mostly. But I'm learning how to tackle a bigger group of people. It just takes a bit more organization and focus. It's like you have to focus for more minds.
It's a bit more organization involved. I wanted to just ask you about some of the songs on the album, on Carry On, which I think is a great album. I think you should be really proud of it.
Thanks.
What Is This is one of the tracks that stuck out, which hit me, which is has a real kind of road movie feel. Was that consciously sort of what you were aiming at? It's quite sort of sombre and reflective, but I can imagine it sort of being a David Lynch film or something like that.
Well, no, I was just thinking about this huge evergreen that was dying on my property.
Okay.
And it
something
was disturbing to me for some reason.
Okay, that's an interesting muse. Take Me Down's another one, which has got a real kind of primal beat. I've read a number of sort of reviews of your last album, your recent album, and some of your last albums. People sort of accuse you, if you like, of almost mixing in reggae. Is that a fair accusation? Do you think there's a reggae beat or a kind of?
Well, sure, reggae is all over pop music. I mean, you can't really play pop music without being influenced by reggae.
Is that something that you knowingly put in there, or do you think it's just something that's kind of wired in your blood, as it were?
No, I didn't decide to make a reggae album.
Do you think you might do one day? Who knows?
I think that the One Drop has been done by better souls than I.
You played also a version of Restless Fugitive, which I suppose is really the kind of anthem, if you like, of the album, of Carry On. It's a really, really great tune, really kind of really quite lifting tune. I think what was the muse for that? What was the motivation for that?
Lots of things, just trying to go home.
There is a longing, I think, in the song, isn't there?
Yeah, I suppose so.
Feeling a bit homesick.
I guess you could call it that, yeah.
Tell me about the cover of the album. It's got a really interesting cover. It's a kind of print, I think, of a lynx, of a cat. Where did you find that?
Oh, I can't tell you about that.
Is it top secret?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's an interesting cover to choose. And in fact, all of your records, I think, today have very intriguing bits of artwork on the front. Is that to capture people's imagination?
Well, it's an opportunity, you know. It's kind of like having your own personal billboard that people are going to carry around for you. So, you know, I feel a responsibility to put something nice on it.
Something a bit mysterious.
Maybe, sure. Yeah.
You're playing a number of dates across the UK in March, and in April, excitingly, you're playing Australia.
Yeah.
I think, is that just yourself? Are you taking some of the band with you? Or?
No, that's just going to be me.
Okay, so you're a kind of lone traveller across, I think you're playing Sydney and Melbourne and... Melbourne, I should say, and Brisbane. You're doing all kind of big places in Australia. Have you played Australia before?
Yeah, I was just over there in October, I think. It was a great tour. Yeah, I was there with Mumford & Sons and Edward Sharp. So it's really big shows, but the crowds are quite focused over there.
So you're not completely alone, then? You've got other bands that you can share a cup of cocoa with in the evening?
Sure. Yeah.
That's good to hear. You're back in June, in the UK in June, at the Isle of Wight Festival.
Mm-hmm.
You're also playing the Gold Coast Festival, which I think is in North Devon, which is an interesting one. And then in July you've got the Cambridge Folk Festival and the Deershed Festival in North Yorkshire, which is not one I'd heard of before. So you've got a number of festivals coming up in the summer. You a festival crowd surfer? Is that a place you feel
festival
comfortable?
Crowd surfer. I've never crowd surfed at a festival, actually. That's a good idea.
Maybe don't do it on my recommendation.
Okay. I'll think about
it'll be a fun thing to do.
Yeah.
We're hiding out in Pine Vinyl at the moment. We're surrounded by records and gatefold sleeves and all kinds of wondrous things. I just wonder, are you a vinyl junkie? Is vinyl something you buy lots of? Or?
I love vinyl. I have a collection back home, but of course I spend most of my time traveling around. So I try to restrain myself.
The record players aren't.
I grew up on vinyl. And
record players aren't quite portable, are they, really?
No.
Not anymore?
No.
So, okay, what about pies? Are you a pie man?
I love pies.
You're a pie fan. I noticed that in one of your songs, If It's the End, I think, which is it the last album, song on Carry On? It says that you're wishing that you could fit your clothes better. There's a lyric in that. Wishing that you fit. Does that fit with the pie eating? Are you trying to stock up?
No, I'm not trying to stock up.
No, okay, that's good.
I do really like pies. Yeah.
Have you got a favorite pie?
I usually go for like steak and ale, or steak and Guinness.
That's a very good choice.
I'm actually waiting on a steak ale in Chilton right now.
Excellent. Well, I won't hold you any more from that.
All right.
William Mason, thanks very much for your time.
Sure.
Thanks for talking to me, and I wish you best of luck on the tour.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Nice talking with you.
Cheers.
Call out, that door is closing, they've left you to run. call out loud. Time has meaning if you want it to. Call out, call out. It carries the question, what will you do? Call out loud. But you got your one-way street, and you kept your first heartbeat. You watched the sun go down, but you felt the earth spin round. You got your reasons here, but you got your unborn kid. You've got the forest floor, you've got the ocean's roar. Frosty sunshine, morning's first blink. Call out, call out. Wake me fast so I don't think. Call out loud. The town just woke up and we're on the brink. Call out, call out. If we're all dying, what makes us distinct? Call out loud. She's got a pickup truck, sleeps in the back when she gets stuck. She's looking for a home, a place in her heart where she can go.
We move now to icons in the shape of David Bowie. And for those of you who've been asleep, I'll just tell you, David Bowie released a brand new album after 10 years on the 11th of March. He did it by stealth, really. I think a lot of people were surprised it emerged. But we're going to start the discussion not about the music, but about the cover. It's a very intriguing and strange cover. If you've seen it kicking around in record stores, I thought it was a holding cover, kind of temporary cover. It looks like a courier has left a sticker on the front of it. Simon, perhaps you'd like to enlighten us as to where it's from and what's the point of it.
Certainly. Well, I've attended talks by the designer who designed this, Jonathan Barnbrook, who's very prolific, and he's designed for David Bowie in the past, notably on his Heathen album cover, and he's also designed the catalogue for the new exhibition, the forthcoming exhibition at the V&A on Bowie's career. So he's very much a designer, a graphic designer that Bowie responds to. So yeah, I think the thing that's worth mentioning is the context of it, because like you say, the first initial single came out of the blue, didn't it? It was just, nobody really knew it was going to come about. It must have been kept quite secret by the record company when it came out. And that single, Where Are We Now, was very delicate, very fragile. It reminded me a bit of Lou Reed's Perfect Day and Berlin era David Bowie. And you kind of got, there was artists involved with this, wasn't there? It was Jacqueline Humphreys and Tony Orsler, the director. And it was a very avant-garde video that created a very specific kind of delicate mood, I thought. And I guess something that Bowie has always done is he has taken avant-garde ideas and then made them accessible as pop culture. I was quite intrigued by this. And then before I even saw the Next Day image, I noticed also there is a portrait of him on the front of the Enemy, which reminded me very much of a serial killer from Halloween movies. It's just a white kind of mask that's very featureless. And then I saw the Next Day artwork and read about what Jonathan Barnbrook, the designer, had to say about it. And the overall impression I got is, okay, this is going to be quite an avant-garde album. This is about him in some ways throwing away his past, because the album cover, which is being obliterated, is Heroes, David Bowie, which I can't remember the exact year. That's 70s, isn't it?
I think it's 77 it came out.
And it's a very iconic kind of pose that he's got with his hands, and a lot of people would recognise that. But he's blocked out the middle of the image, so you can't actually see his face. And then just in simple sans serif text, you've got the Next Day. And like you say, it's almost like someone just put a white post-it note on top of it. They've also crossed out the title Hero, so you can just see David Bowie in the top corner. And if you go to the back cover as well, it's a similar thing. You can just about see that on the edges, there's the original track listing for the Heroes album. But again, there's this white post-it note sized block with text on with the new album track listing. Yeah, I guess what I thought he was trying to say was, you know, there's expectations. When David Bowie comes back after 10 years without releasing anything, you know, we don't look at David Bowie, you know, just on flat level. We look at him with all of his past behind him. And this album cover, it's rejecting the past or blocking the past somehow, but also somehow kind of admitting that it's not, you can't really experience David Bowie without looking at the past. As you go inside, that kind of block theme continues, like the square becomes like an identity for the album. You've got another more modern portrait, a contemporary portrait of him, again blocked by this post-it note size block. And on the side of the sleeve as well, there's a little block in between the title of the album and the actual artist's name. From what I've seen, this becomes very predominant in the way that he's been promoted generally. You see it in a lot of newspaper adverts, for example. So yeah, that was my understanding of it. This is what he was trying to do.
There's a significant thing, actually. I've just thought about what you were talking there, that the original Heroes album cover does have a quite iconic picture of, I'm using the iconic word again, but the iconic picture of David Bowie really is a mime, blank canvas, as a kind of muse, if you like. Which is interesting, because what he's kind of saying is this is the latest iteration of the idea of David Bowie, you know, because David Bowie is very much a character, I think. You know, he's very much a kind of canvas in some ways. I have to say, I mean, initially I kind of rejected the kind of album cover and thought, oh, this is just a bit lazy. I'm not really clear about what this is. I'd much rather prefer the image that's inside the gatefold CD pack to have been on the front cover, because I can recognise it, it looks great. But actually, as I've thought more and more about it, it kind of works for me, I think. What about you, Dave? What was your reaction to this?
I didn't have any reaction to it initially, really. I just felt very cold about it. I didn't care about it and was quite keen to listen to music. It's fascinating to hear what Simon's said, and he's found out some reasons for it. And there are two things that have gone through my head as a consequence of it. One is, I quite like that idea of deliberately negating the past. But we were talking earlier with the kitai about whether you can understand the symbolism of something, whether it matters. And I was saying, I didn't care about the symbolism. I like the sensuousness of that particular picture. So I don't like the non-sensuousness of this album cover. So I'm kind of thinking in my head, well, okay, if I'd wanted to do what this guy's done, in other words, you know, present Bowie's past and obliterate it, here's a different strategy, for example, which is that you have, like, say, 9 images, you know, in little squares, like a contact sheet. And you know with contact sheets where they cross around and circle and so on? So one of them would have been the next day. You'd have circled that one and crossed out the other ones. And if you'd have done it in a big, bold black pen with, you know, clearly hand done, there would have been a more sensuous thing to it. So, I mean, I'm not saying he got it wrong, but... it leaves me cold, which is the only part of the album that leaves me cold at all.
It's interesting.
Funny.
The interesting thing about, because on Jonathan Barnbrook's blog, he mentions that he wants to deal with detachment, because he felt a lot of the album was about detachment. And Bowie chose this design out of several designs that were presented to him, possibly for those reasons. But interesting you say about the album, because I felt both this and the music video that came before it kind of were like a little bit of a red herring, because I was expecting the album to go in one way, and then I listened to it and it went bosh, totally in a different way. I heard one of the producers on the album saying they wanted it to be blistering rock, and it's very up-tempo all the way through, and the Where Are We Now single is really the only, I would say, the most solemn part of the album, certainly in terms of musical kind of atmosphere. There's maybe melancholy in the lyrics, but it's all behind these very pulsing drums and heavy rock guitars.
Just to explain to listeners, it going a bit bosh is Simon's reference to the Berlin era Heroes album. There are a couple of things I've picked up on the Jonathan Barnbrook blog. There's a couple of quotes from him I think are interesting. He says, no matter how much we try, we cannot break free of the past. And he said, it's being of the moment. That's what he's trying to demonstrate. And it's an obscuring of an image from the past, which is about the wider human condition. There is something, I think, about the speed in which the album sort of appeared. And I mentioned in the introduction that it came from nowhere. It seems that the album cover, it almost looks like it's been done very quickly. There's an immediacy to it. You know, it's been, right, what should we do? Stick that on there, stick it out, whatever. But I'm sure there's more to it than that.
I would have thought, I can see how you could think that, but from what I've read, that wasn't the case. They came up with lots and lots of ideas, and this is the one that was chosen. I think the thing to think about is that there was a lot of expectation leading up to this album, and this image, or lack of image, is what people would have been presented with. So it kept people guessing right up until the last minute when the album actually was released. And I think that was something that Barry is very keen to do. He said that he wanted to kind of surprise people with the album, to kind of go in one direction with all the stuff that preceded it, and then for there almost to be an explosion of a cork when you first listen to the album, and it was very different to what the preceding culture surrounding it had led you to believe.
Well, let's move then to the meat of the album in terms of the music. Amazingly, the album sold 94,000 copies in its first week. I think it's gone straight to the UK album chart, first top spot, as they say. I think Alan Freeman used to describe it in that way. It's his 24th studio album, and as Simon mentioned earlier, I think it's 10 years since his last album, Reality. Again, an album that felt very different and looked very different, but this is kind of an album about moving on in some ways, isn't it? It's about reflection and kind of moving on from past and taking some baggage with you, but not all.
Yeah, I think there are quite a lot of references to the past. I mean, I suppose the most blindingly obvious one is that the chorus in one of the tracks, and I can't remember which one it is now, where they actually just they sing that little refrain from Apache by The Shadows, which for people of his generation and my generation is one of the major... It's the bit of music that we all learned before the Beatles came along. Everybody learned to play Apache, actually. And funnily enough, I'm learning to play the guitar in old age now, and it's one of the things I play, you know. So I mean, but we all, you know, it was where, you know, when you talked, when you listen, you know, Eric Clapton or whatever, you say, where did you, you know, it was like we started with Skiffle and The Shadows, and there are references to the past, and there are little lines in it to the past. And there was a thing that struck me about it, which is because I am quite close to his age. I'm not quite as old as him, but I'm only about two and a half years younger, I think, which is that when you get to our age, your awareness of mortality, I think, by and large increases. I don't know, it's true, I can't speak for everybody, but I think it probably does. And I think that that's one of the things that comes through loud and clear in this, that there are lots of references to death and graveyards and so on and so on. So, you know, and it seems in some way that he might be checking out his past stylistically and so on and so on, thinking about the fact there's not much of a future. But in the present, to pick up the comments of that designer, in the present, there is just such energy. It just knocks me dead. I think it's fantastic.
There is. I mean, one thing I said to Dave last week when we were just discussing it, I said it sounds very fresh. You know, there's still that kind of that angst and that kind of attacking anger.
Yeah.
And I think overridingly, you know, it's the voice. You know, it's very much a case of 66 and not out. You know, his voice is still very kind of, you know, it has a great integrity. It can really kind of not just hold a note, but it kind of lifts it to another another level, I think.
It's a very lyric heavy album, even by Barry's standards, isn't it? There's a lot to kind of listen to repeatedly to find out what the story is, and I found there's quite a lot of storytelling on the album. And although he deals with old age, he in parts, I think, he also deals with a lot of younger characters. So there's a 17-year-old soldier in a very, I'd say, almost like an anti-war song, and he sings from his perspective. There's Valentine's Day, which focuses on a teenage boy. There's also on a kind of 22-year-old woman who is kind of like a scarlet and is considered very successful and glamorous, but is kind of despairing underneath it. There's all these kind of characters, and although they reference maybe some, they kind of, through them he channels maybe some of the emotions he's having at this stage of his life. It's interesting that he chooses to go back to younger characters so often.
He obviously missed a trick releasing an album with a track called Valentine's Day in March, but you know, kind of, I'm not sure it's just about selling albums. And to be honest, you know what, David Bowie could pretty much release anything, and I think there would be sales there. But it's the credibility, isn't
it? Well, tell me about that. That's interesting, because I mean, I lost touch with David Bowie. Really, I was a big fan of David Bowie in the 70s, and then just and I liked Ashes to Ashes, I think, which came some years after that. But then there was all that Tin Machine stuff, which I didn't care about really. And I mean, presumably people could have lost interest in the records he makes, just as they lost realistically lost interest in a lot of I mean, there seems, you know, Rod Stewart sells a lot of records, but he sells it by being a real old timer. You know, he doesn't do anything inventive at all. Paul McCartney doesn't sell a lot of records anymore. He makes a lot of records, but by his standards, he doesn't. So Bowie could have bombed. It could have been a not very interesting album that nobody cared about. So, you know, whether it is because people want to relive some relationship with the great Bowie of the past, and they bought the album anyway and are now really relieved that it's good, or whether somehow they did get to hear it in the first 2 days and then all went, oh, wow, let's buy it. I mean, what do you think about that?
Why isn't it
Tin Machine, because it's a lot better, but...
I think Tin Machine was probably a regrettable period, yes. An interesting period. But I mean, for me, I think this is very much an album that David Bowie wanted to make. You know, it was not as though anyone was pushing him to make it. I think one of the key kind of collaborators, if you like, is Tony Visconti, who's his kind of co-producer again. You know, and was significantly involved in Man Who Sold the World. Yeah. Heathen, you mentioned Scary Monsters, those
reality.
Kind of reality, all those kind of different albums. And I think, you know, Bowie has that kind of, he's got that privilege, I suppose, in terms of being able to step back and step out of the world in which he kind of, you know, has created the image of David Bowie and go off and do all kinds of different things. In the same way, I suppose, as Peter Gabriel, somebody else who kind of just thinks, I want to go off and explore music, I want to find different things. And then if I come back and make an album that's cover versions of my songs with other people, that's fine, I can do that. Or if I go come back and do my greatest hits, essentially, but with no guitars and drums, that's an interesting project for me. If people like it, great. If they don't, they don't.
I think if you like the heyday of David Bowie's stuff from, say, the 70s or so, I think you probably would find quite a lot in this album. It's not, I wouldn't say it's like an avant-garde album, which is maybe a description that fits works that he's done in the last 15 years or so more. This feels much more like a rock album that is more, you know, it's got choruses, it's very catchy, it's got guitar riffs, it's quite up-tempo. It feels like if you were a fan of his work back in those eras, you would probably find something in this album more than you would do, for example, with Heathen or the more experimental albums that he made, you know, in the last 20 years. Because he hasn't had a number one album, was it, in 20 years? And now he's got back to them. And I think that says something about, I think it is a slight change in direction. I think it's less experimental than maybe the more recent albums.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, there was a question I was going to pose to you, and it was about, you know, is David Bowie still the outsider? You know, is he still kind of a set and aside from the kind of mainstream rock and rock and roll, if you like? And I think he is, and I think this album demonstrates that he is doing something very different. You won't find many commercial stations playing David Bowie, current David Bowie. You know, they will play Starman, and they might play Moon Age Daydream if they're feeling a little bit edgy, but they won't take something from The Next Day.
But even if it's the biggest number one album and stays number one all year, I mean, you know, because actually, if that's true, and it may well be true because you know these things better than I do, but if it's true, it begs the question of what on earth commercial radio stations think they're doing.
Yeah. Wow.
You know, if actually commercial radio means only playing rubbish, which it's, I suspect it does from my limited experience. I mean, I normally only listen to it when I'm at the dentist, you know, but and it is always trite.
Less painful.
You know, so, but if they're saying, oh, well, what we play is what people like, and you have the biggest selling album of the year, and they still won't play it because it doesn't sound right, then they're not commercial either. They're just rubbish.
I think radio stations are very different to when he was, you know, in his heyday as well. I think, you know, we've now got all these different radio stations, even just on the BBC's kind of availability, that, you know, of different tastes. Like BBC One, Radio One, is much more aimed primarily at a teenage audience now than it used to be. It used to have a wider span than that. And you've now got stations such as Six Music, which I think this definitely would appear on. I think probably even BBC Two might play some of it on certain shows. And I wonder, I think maybe tracks like You'll Set the World on Fire, I can see that as like a, you know, like a drive time stomping kind of guitar track that they would play. I think the way I describe the album is, if you're a fan of David Bowie already, this album probably won't, you probably won't be disappointed. I don't know if it will change your life. I don't think it's as consistent as classic Bowie albums, and maybe it wouldn't be the best album for a newcomer to Bowie to listen to, but I think most of the people who bought the album probably had a prior knowledge of Bowie, and they're relieved to hear him again, and they enjoy being in his presence again. For me, I think the album started off with a lot of gusto, but maybe lost its path a little bit towards the end, and maybe I need to listen to it more, but I wouldn't class it as a classic Bowie album quite. I think it's an interesting addition to his career path, and I'm intrigued to see if he does do another album or two after this. And this is another late period. I mean, he did what, like over 20 tracks for this album. There's only what, 10 or 12 on the official one. It feels like there's still life in this. It feels like there's momentum here. It doesn't feel like a closing statement.
Dave, your final thoughts on The Next Day?
Two things, really. One is that I think he sounds to me like a member of a band, and I mean that entirely positively, as opposed to a solo singer with a bunch of people playing what he wants them to play. And I like that hugely, and I think that that's how he grew up and where he came from, and I think that works really well, and it's one of the reasons why McCartney struggles these days, and it's one of the reasons why for me Dylan works, because he still goes out with a working band on the road. I know Dylan's not on the road, but Bowie's not on the road, but it sounds like that. The other thing about it is that I love pop music, and I don't think he's ever been an avant-garde musician. I think if you want avant-garde music, go to avant-garde musicians, experimental musicians. What he is a great, great pop musician. Mm. You know, he's one of the most inventive, and he's the most consistently inventive, imaginative British pop musician there's ever been. Ever, you know,
you don't say that lightly.
There might have been people like Lennon and McCartney for a few years, but you know, over a period of 40 years, he is the most imaginative and inventive British pop musician, and I think that, and I mean that entirely to praise him. Really, I don't care whether he thinks he's avant-garde or not, because I don't think he is. You know, go listen to Stockhausen or Steve Reich or something if that's what you want. It doesn't matter. One of the reasons he's a great pop musician is that most of it you can dance to. And if you can't, you can tap your foot to it. And I think that's a pretty key criterion, actually, for great pop music. I think it's wonderful. I love it.
Just before we sign off, we've just got time to catch up with a couple of events that you might want to check out for yourself. On the 15th of April, you can check out British Sea Power at the Wedgwood Rooms in Portsmouth, touring their brand new album, Machineries of Joy. Call the box office on 023 9286 3911.
I've got two. One at Eastleigh Cellars on the 2nd of April, 1960s rhythm and blues legends, The Pretty Things. And then on the 12th of April, these new events at the Guildhall, the James Taylor Quartet. Very, very fine keyboard-led modern jazz.
Okay, if you're interested in the Kitai exhibition, you may be interested in going on to a talk on Thursday, the 28th of March. It's people very close to Kitai, architects MJ Long and art historian Marco Livingstone, who both played significant roles in his life. For example, the London studio of Kitai was designed by MJ Long. They're going to discuss their friendship with the late painter. That's Thursday the 28th of March at 6 p.m.
Excellent stuff. And if you're not a fan of comedy, you can go and check out Jim Davidson and Jethro, who are bringing a curious double act to the Guildhall in Portsmouth on Wednesday the 3rd of April. Just before we go, I should just plug our blog. You can find all the weird and wonderful things that we've been talking about there. It's towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. Our thanks to Pie and Vinyl for their help in bringing us Willie Mason. My thanks to Dave and to Simon. Our next show is on Monday the 22nd of April. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.